This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Glenn Gilbo. He's the beat writer for Gannett News, for LSU sports, including Tiger football. Currently, fans in box suites are allowed to consume all kinds of alcohol, beer, hard liquor, wine, you name it. It's available in the suites, but not in the stands. Could this be a way to raise money for LSU? As Athletic Director Joe Oliva says, he needs at least $2 million more to balance the budget for next year. He wants ticket hikes. Is that better than beer sales at Tiger Stadium? We'll talk about it with Glenn Gilbo. Also, Johnny Palazzotto, the music promoter from Baton Rouge. His friend Johnny Rivers is in town. We'll talk about Saturday night at Baton Rouge High. And Herbie Pilato on the remarkable career of the actress Elizabeth Montgomery. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757 by email inkstershow@wrkf.org. Glenn Gilbo is in the house. Beat writer for LSU Sports, for Gannett, columnist for Tiger Rag Magazine and TigerRag.com. Good morning, Glenn Gilbo.
Good morning.
Good to join you on Nick Saban's 62nd birthday.
Is that why you invited me?
Yeah.
It's also Dale Brown's 78th.
That is correct.
Let's get that in there.
And Dan Rather's 82nd.
Okay.
But Saban was coach at LSU, as we know, and in 5 years won two SEC titles and a BCS crown. And he's done fairly well since he left here.
Yeah, he was talking about the LSU game yesterday on the teleconference, and he was talking about how this game has gotten so big, and he was talking about how great Les was and the LSU staff, and then he said, and we've done pretty good.
He has done well. What's the magic of Saban?
Pete Jenkins said this when he first got the job at LSU in 2000. He said, and this was before Saban had really done much. I mean, he had one great season, one very good season at Michigan State and a bunch of average ones. But he said Nick was the best coach he knew that could do it all, coach a position, be a head coach, recruit, deal with the media, just has everything. And he's gotten better over the years as he's gotten older, whereas some of us and in other businesses kind of get worse as you get older. He's really just refined his game and is just, really at the top of his game. Mm-hmm. And, he's going to go down as one of the best ever. I don't think there's any question.
Well, before we get to the topic at hand, do you think LSU has any shot of winning in Tuscaloosa?
I do. Les Miles, who, by the way, is the only coach beaten Saban in recent years with any regularity. He's beaten him three times since 2007. No one else has done that. Spurrier's beaten him three times, but the first two were in 2000 and 2001. Before that, you got to go back to Joe Tiller, the Purdue coach, beat Saban three times when he was in Michigan State. So Les is, kind of the only one that can get him on a consistent basis. But, yes, I do. I think they're going to have a chance because LSU always plays Alabama well under Les, even when they're not having a great season. He's beaten them when he's had a loss. He lost to him in overtime in 2008 when he had two losses like this season and really could have won that game and really could have won a couple of the games that he's lost. So yeah, I think LSU will have a chance to win this game.
My guess is if Saban were still the coach, we would have beer sales in Tiger Stadium. he got involved in every aspect of the program.
He did.
And he would know. He's got a very good mind when it comes to math. And when you do the math, there's enormous upside as far as revenue from selling beer. And instead of raising prices on fans, my guess is that Saban would say, tell the athletic director, we're going to have beer sales. Why don't we have beer sales?
Well, it is kind of ridiculous because, everybody's drinking beer all around the stadium, The reason you don't have beer sales at other events is because you don't want drunk people at the event, like at church or something or at a funeral. I mean, but you can see by looking at the video board during the games that those kids are doing something, before the game. And you can just smell it walking around the stadium. So, I mean, if everybody's drinking outside the game, I don't see the difference in letting them drink during the game. And you also have – there's other people that are drinking during the game, you know, in the suites
and
so forth.
In the suites, you can drink beer, you can drink wine. Right. And as I noted, there's enough Crown consumed in the suites on Saturday night to fill University Lake. And – it is something that is allowed for the high rollers, the big supporters, but not for the average fan. John McKithen, the former governor, has to be turning in his grave over this.
Well, and, you know, another reason not to have beer sales is crowd control. Well, everybody is drinking already, so they've got the crowd control under control, if you will. So they know how to deal with that, the people that work at Tiger Stadium. So I think it's something that they could handle. You know, it'd probably be good to cut off the beer sales maybe in the third quarter or something like they do at baseball games. But, yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense.
For years, the media would drink. LSU would provide beer after the games, post-game warm down. Do they still do that?
No, they cut that out entirely, I think, last year. But definitely they're not available this year. And, yeah, that Joe Oliva never did like that, and he eventually – got rid of that, but
I'm sure some people like Scooter Hobbs were not pleased with that.
Well, you know, there's I've noticed a lot of the out of town riders when they come in after the game, they're like, "Hey, where's the beer?" You know, that's going away. It used to be neat when they had it. They had a gold warm down lounge, and everybody would meet and congregate. The athletic department, even the coaches would come in there. Curly would come in there. Arnsparger, that was good. It had gotten away from that anyway, so it's not that big a deal, I don't think.
But beer could raise big money at Tiger Stadium and for LSU if it were allowed to be consumed and giving fans the opportunity to purchase it in the regular stadium. It is allowed in the suites. They'll have 60 new suites next year. The capacity goes to 101,000. Why can it be allowed in the suites and not in the regular stadium?
Yeah, I've never heard a good answer for that. And it would certainly make more sense than this ticket price hike that Mr. Oliva is planning at this point, particularly with another $14 million coming in from the SEC ESPN deal. I don't quite understand the need for that, as neither do some members of the board. This would make more sense to make money. Instead of just putting it on the consumer or the fans. And, you know, I think a lot of schools like LSU, too, are overstaffed in the athletic department. That could save a little money as well.
I'm sure you're making a lot of friends at the athletic department right now.
I mean, how many assistant ADs do you need? 12? You know,
does LSU have 12?
I think they have about 10 or 11. But you know, it's the same thing in Alabama. I mean, you're crossing over with duties. You know, it's just there's just too much, and I think they you know, they've kind of gone overboard with the office space and buildings and facilities in general, and really I think LSU may be building too big of a stadium as well. I mean, if they're having trouble filling it now, you just got to be careful there.
Right.
If you get too big.
297-5633 Glenn Gilbo, beat writer for LSU for Gannett News. And LSU next year, as it expands to 101,000, this is the home schedule the Tigers will present in 2014. Sam Houston State, New Mexico State, University of Louisiana Monroe, Kentucky, Mississippi State, Ole Miss, and Alabama.
You know, you made a great point in your column about beer sales, Jim, when you said it's like going to see a you know, Frank Sinatra, and he doesn't play any of his hits. You know, you're going to see LSU, this great tailgating university, and they're playing Kent State. You know, it's really a good point. And you know, that's something they need to think about because, you know, LSU's been so successful, their fans are getting sophisticated and spoiled, you know. And that's why, you know, they don't get up for Mississippi State anymore or some of these non-conference games. So that's what we're seeing. You know, it's kind of created a monster. I mean, got to have more than just the Alabama game.
And last week at the homecoming with Furman, there were a number of empty seats at the start of the game, maybe a third of the stadium, maybe.
It looked like a scrimmage. I mean, it looked like the spring game at times.
And then at the end of the game, it looked like it did the night Florida beat LSU 58-3 when Curly Hallman was coaching the Tigers. It was almost a wasteland.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think when LSU plays Furman or when Alabama plays Georgia State or Chattanooga and Coastal Carolina is on an SEC schedule, those are the best reasons to go to a nine-game SEC schedule. Because, you know, especially this time of year, you know, you should play those Furmans and those exhibition games in September, early in the season, get them out of the way, and then go all SEC. You know, as Alan Richer, I heard him the other day, we never had open weeks, he was saying. Now not only do they have two open weeks, they also have a third open week, basically, with Furman. And Alabama has, you know, an open week with Chattanooga. So I think after September, it's got to be all SEC games.
297-5633. We will go to the lines in just a moment. Did want to note that President Fielding King Alexander was at the Baton Rouge Press Club Monday, and F. King Alexander, the new president and chancellor of LSU, he expressed his opposition to selling beer in Tiger Stadium.
We don't, and it seems to work fine. And I think you may be asking for a lot more problems because most of our games are at night. And many of those, I venture to say that some of them have had a beer or two when they come in the game. So I think then you've got a cutoff time. I think that our night games make that even more difficult and more challenging. But it's not something that we've even discussed. Not something that's even come up for us.
Do night games have anything to do with the price of beer in Tiger Stadium?
I'm not sure where he's going there because, you know, again, if you're already – have an audience that's already drinking, it's not going to matter if they drink in the stadium. You know, maybe they'll come into the stadium anyway, and you don't even know if they're going to consume more if they can in the stadium, because if they know they can drink in the stadium, they might not drink as much before the game, you know. So and again, the problems that he alluded to, I think they're already dealing with that. The Tiger Stadium personnel knows how to deal with drunk people, okay? That's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, the suites have been open for 14 years, and I've had occasion to be there a few times, and there aren't fights at that level, and people generally behave themselves. And it makes LSU appear to be an elitist university when people who are capable of paying the freight to sit in a suite, they're able to drink anything they want, by the way. And the fans in the stands can't buy a beer.
Yeah, wasn't it McKithen who said, you know, the people in the stands are going to get the cigarette ashes on them, and now they're going to get drops of Crown Royal on them.
That's true. They do. They do, because you can reach out and touch people in the stands from the suite. And next year there will be more suites and there will be more alcohol consumed. But if you're a fan, and now the tickets are $70 a piece too, and you have to pay a tradition fee if you're a season ticket holder. We're talking probably about a $5,000 investment for a family of four to attend LSU football and go to the seven games next year. That'll be Sam Houston State, New Mexico State, UL Monroe, Kentucky, Mississippi State, Ole Miss, and Alabama.
Right.
Better hope the Alabama game is really good.
Yeah, and hopefully they'll have the traffic issues solved that they had this year, which added to some of the problems that, you know, kept fans away. The traffic getting to and from the games because of the construction and new traffic routes.
HB in Denham Springs. Hi, HB.
Good morning. Just a quick comment you made about Nick Saban being able to handle the news media. My question is this. With the remarks that Les Miles made concerning his raise, that he needed a raise to put four kids into college, and also what he said that I think couldn't even be printed in the paper, about 2 weeks ago at another press conference, how much damage, if any, do you think he did to himself when you consider the median income of Louisiana is around $40,000 to $45,000?
Actually, it's much lower than that, but Glenn, go ahead.
You know, I think Les is, people have gotten used to hearing him say some goofy things here and there, and it's not as significant maybe as it used to be, and he's really popular. Still, I mean, he's not popular right now with the two losses, but I don't think that he's
all
damaging
right,
himself.
297-5633. Back with Glenn Gilbo in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Kevin Gallagher producing. In a bit, Johnny Palazzotto, the famed music promoter. And he is in town, as he usually is, with a good friend, Johnny Rivers, who will be in Baton Rouge Saturday night, along with Zachary Richard. But we continue with the Twin G, Glenn Gilbo. He's been covering LSU since 1983. And in that year, LSU had a disastrous season, going 4-7. The stands by the end of the games were largely empty. And last week, with LSU now 7-2, ranked 11th in the nation, the stands were largely empty. They were playing Furman. We are asking you, as we discuss it, whether beer should be available to the general public at Tiger Stadium as it is to people who sit in luxury suites. 297-5633, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Glenn, it doesn't seem like at this point that there's a lot of momentum for this, but it may very well happen. I would think at some point it'll almost have to happen with there being a double standard.
Well, this has come up before, and I just think that LSU's avoided it because it's kind of a sensitive issue, because you get the Bible Belt into it, and it looks bad, you know, on the surface, and I think that's why they've avoided it, even though it is kind of contradictory, because everybody's drinking before the game. Why can't you drink at the game? I've never understood that. But it's, you know, I'd be surprised if it happens anytime soon.
Steve in Mid-City says, I find the new sound system to be irritatingly loud.
I agree.
Overpowers the Tiger Band and makes people want to put earplugs in.
Yeah, the musical choices have not been good. And you know, I'm early 50s, and I mean, I'm 52, so I don't really like the modern music, but there's modern music. There's music coming out now that's a lot better than what they're playing in the stadium. And really, the band never even plays in the stadium, which is ridiculous. You know, they're paying a lot of money to put nice uniforms on those guys and travel them around, and they don't even play. So they need to play more football-related music at the games too.
Well, if LSU is going to play Furman, for heaven's sakes, why in the world doesn't LSU play Southern University? At least we would have a good halftime show.
Well, you know, if you're going to play Furman, you ought to have maybe a live band in the stadium. Certainly they'd have enough room in some of the sections. you could have the country music shows they have in May. You could make that during a game.
You could just make it an extension of Bayou Country Superfest,
yeah, there you go.
Right?
Right, okay. Fall Bayou Country Superfest.
Well, Johnny Palazzotto just took a seat. You couldn't keep him silent on this one. What were you saying, Johnny?
I think the players have something to say about the music that is played. They do at the baseball games, I know that.
I don't think they do at the football games. The baseball, each player, each batter has a song when he hits, which is cool. And those are better songs than they're playing for the football, I can tell you. Okay.
Here's one. I'm reading some emails. By the way, if you'd like to call, 297-5633. Les Miles averages 10 wins a year. This person writes, yes, some fans want him fired. How much do you have to win to keep people happy?
Well, Les's overall record is great. I mean, that's a ridiculous emotional stance if people want Les fired this year. And really, the comment earlier about him saying he's got to raise his four kids, you know, he was kidding about that. Les has never really, you know, gone after more money when he's coach. In fact, he was stuck at the same salary.
Stuck?
He remained at the same salary from 2007 on until just a year or so ago. You know, he was right at 3.8, and that was based on, because he won the national championship.
$3.8 million.
Yeah, it was written in his contract. But, you know, he's not nearly as high in salary ranking as he used to be. You know, he was at one time like number two or three. He's still probably in the top 10, but he's not as high as
but
he was.
If he had won the BCS championship game on January 9th, 2012, it was in his contract that he was to be paid more than.
But he didn't win it. He didn't win it.
He did not win it. That was an expensive loss for Leslie Edwin Miles.
It was. But I just don't think. I mean, Les is the way he sees it is, I'm making a lot of money. I'm not going to, you know, fight over this and that like other coaches have.
Well, Les Miles is on the record as saying that he would like beer sales at Tiger Stadium.
He
would like to see the fans consume a beer or two while they're...
Maybe they wouldn't notice the clock management issues as well until they saw the replay. Huh?
Well, there's Les Miles fighting for the common fan.
Well,
he's a man of the people, isn't he?
I would say he's more a man of the people than a lot of people at LSU, for sure.
Well, he went to a good public university. The athletic director went to Duke. Actually, went to Lehigh and then was at Duke for many, many years as
a... Well, I can tell assistant. You, a prominent attorney in town, when I was going through trying to get some public records, told me that they often have to remind Joe Oliva that he is not at a private school. And I think you saw that again last week when he tried to push through this ticket increase. You know, he called the Board of Supervisors...
burdensome.
Yeah, burdensome. Well, I mean, that's what a state school is. If that's burdensome, he might need to go back to a private school.
Well, he's a guy who took for all intents, took the job as AD at Tennessee and then backed away to stay at LSU. It looks like he'll be here for a while.
Well, I mean, I think he's probably a pretty good AD. He doesn't have good contacts with the media. He doesn't like doing interviews. In fact, he stormed out of an interview last week after the Board of Supervisors meeting when somebody brought up to him that he's getting $14 million from the new SEC TV deal, and then why are you raising ticket prices? But, you know, just because he doesn't get along with the media doesn't mean he's not a good AD. I mean, I think he's, you know, he went through the economic despair that was around the nation a few years ago. They handled that well. They consolidated some jobs. He's hired a good basketball coach. But
well,
he needs
that,
to.
That brings us to a question here from Janet, who writes that Joe Oliva hired Trent Johnson, who won one SEC championship in 4 years, 25%. Les Miles has won two SEC championships in 9 years, 22%. He was hired by Skip Bertman. Isn't Trent Johnson a better coach than Les Miles?
Somebody's upset about the Ole Miss loss, I think.
Well, it is true that LSU's only won two SEC titles in 9 years under Miles. They won two in 5 years under Saban.
Well, he's won two. He made another one in 2005, and you know he's been averaging around double-digit wins each year. He won a national championship, made the national championship game a second time, and then there's been two or three years where he was close to getting into that mix, and you know, so they're always on that upper echelon. So, and he's continued to recruit well. I mean, I think you could argue that the 2011 LSU team was as good or better than the 2003 national championship team
and the 2007 team.
Yeah.
Now LSU, I'm responding to another question from a listener, is not the only school in Louisiana that might have beer sales at football games. It's done at Tulane, has been for years.
And that didn't help attendance.
No, but it's done. UL Lafayette has it. UL Monroe has it. Why not LSU? You talked about the Bible Belt.
Yeah. I can't argue against it. I think it would be a good move.
Well, Bill Bryan writes, should LSU resume its yearly series with Tulane? Is it possible that LSU could play Tulane in the Liberty Bowl this year?
Oh gosh, I don't think either team would like that game. You know, it is funny. They stopped playing Tulane. Jodine was behind not playing Tulane anymore. But if you're going to play Furman and you're going to play Kent State, you might as well play Tulane. And really, that was the argument to start playing McNeese in Northwestern State. If you're playing Appalachian State, play McNeese State, you know. Save your in-state schools some money and yourself some money, not bringing in these out-of-state lighter opponents. And goodness knows, there's all kind of colleges, small colleges in terms of football, that play in Louisiana. It'd make more sense to play them than Kent State and Furman. So,
all right.
Yeah, I would say play Tulane.
Allen says the average fan doesn't know that alcohol consumption is permitted in the suites, and it is because of this. Will there be an outcry about the double standard at LSU? Does it make the people in the stands second-class citizens, Glenn?
I don't know if they look at it like that. If they're not aware of it, they don't know about it. But
hopefully they'll be aware of it after they hear this show.
The Tiger Stadium, a game there is a party atmosphere of food and drink, and I don't think the people are that upset that they can't drink in the stadium. To me, it doesn't make sense, but it's not like they're really upset about it. I mean, they can't drink at the baseball games either, and there's still a large festive atmosphere because you can do that before the game, and then you can come out of the stadium and go back in baseball. I don't think you can do that in football,
no,
though.
No, you can't. Yeah. You can't. Becca Ferris writes, I would get completely behind alcohol sales to boost income because our family has had the same season tickets since before my 93-year-old grandmother went to LSU in the 1930s. Is struggling to afford seats with the rising costs and tradition fund. We are middle-class folks for whom LSU football is a five-generation family tradition. Our tickets are a family heirloom. Surely there is another way to pay the bills besides draining the hardworking, loyal fans even more.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. And really, the least creative way to raise money is to raise prices. And that's all Mr. Oliva wants to do. I think they ought to be able to come up with something better. And one idea is beer sales.
Here's another question from a listener. Why is LSU playing Wisconsin in next year's season opener in Houston rather than Tiger Stadium?
Well, just like the reason they played TCU in Dallas and North Carolina in Atlanta, they get a large enough guarantee, like a couple million dollars or so, to where it's a wash missing that home game. So, but again, the fans suffer who want to go to games in Tiger Stadium.
And this one involves a return game at Lambeau Field in Green Bay, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and they'll get a guarantee for that, too.
Yeah, but why didn't they? Game. They could have played in New Orleans rather than Houston and showcase their new running back from New Orleans. Are they going to get the kid from St. Aug?
I think so, Geno Fournette, yeah. No, I like that bit of LSU scheduling. Playing in Houston, which is a big alumni base, a big recruiting area. Playing in Dallas and Atlanta, which are big recruiting bases and I don't know how much alumni is in Atlanta, but there's a lot in Dallas. I think the SEC is doing a good job in recent years of marketing its product outside of the SEC. LSU playing up in Wisconsin to me is great. A lot of LSU fans who'll get to go, who want to go, that's quite an experience to see your team play it where the Packers played. I think that's cool scheduling.
Well, thank you, Glenn Gilbo. Good to talk with you, and let's visit again soon.
Thank you.
We're joined in studio by Johnny Palazzotto, music promoter from Baton Rouge. Left his hometown, went to California, came back several years ago. Johnny Palazzotto, you are in your element this week. You've got your good friend Johnny Rivers in tow, coming back home. The man who grew up on Convention Street will be at Baton Rouge High Saturday night.
It's truly a great week for me. Today I get to facilitate music in the schools at Riverside Academy and Reserve with Deacon John Moore and Johnny Rivers. And tomorrow we'll do music in the schools here at McKinley High School with Herman Jackson, who is the brother of Randy Jackson of American Idol, but he is also now B.B. King's drummer and just came back in off the road. And he and Johnny Rivers will be at McKinley High School tomorrow afternoon.
Johnny Rivers is rock and roll royalty. He was talking about Whiskey A Go-Go on this show yesterday, and he opened that club, which is still around Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. And I was looking. He closed the Whiskey A Go-Go in 68 on New Year's Eve, 69, New Year's Eve. And he was the first act to ever perform there. He's a guy who's, it's hard to believe, he'll be 71 years old next week. He's been around as a top-flight performer for almost a half century.
He's definitely a phenomenon. There are many great stories about his beginnings here in Baton Rouge with John Fred and Jimmy Clanton and the Clanton brothers. And then he was, before he was at the Whiskey A Go-Go, he was performing at Gazzari's, which was a club right up the street from the Whiskey A Go-Go. And I think the Valentine brothers, or one of the Elmer Valentine, coerced him in to coming and playing at the Whiskey.
His first huge hit was in 1964. That's 49 years ago. Memphis, Number 2. There's a story behind that, isn't there?
I haven't heard that directly from him, but yeah, I understand there was an Elvis connection of sorts.
They both wanted that song, didn't they?
I think they both recorded the song, and the story that I've heard secondhand was that Elvis had recorded it, and Johnny recorded it too, and knew that Elvis was about to record it and released it before he did, which... You know, the old blues guys used to call that cutting one another. And so I would imagine
he
that
cut
it's
Elvis.
A tradition, a blues-type tradition.
1964, when Johnny would have been 21, he cuts the king, Elvis Aaron Presley.
He's got a very, very successful career. You know, he's the publisher of Up, Up, and Away, a song that was recorded by the Fifth Dimension. Also, Glenn Campbell's hits, which were written by Jimmy Webb. Johnny Rivers is the publisher of that.
By the time I get to Phoenix. He commented that he did the song first, gave it to Glenn Campbell.
Yep.
Of course, Glenn had, that may have been his biggest hit.
I think it really was one of the bigger ones in the early part.
And Johnny Rivers, he's got a great, great voice, great sound, and still does. He hasn't lost it. Here he is with his version. Kevin has it. He tells me, by the time I get to Phoenix.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note that I left hanging on her door. She'll laugh when she reads the part
he just won
that says I'm leaving. Cause I've left that girl.
That's Johnny Rivers, by the time I get to Phoenix. He didn't mind a bit that Glenn Campbell made it a monster hit. He, in fact, it made Johnny even more money.
He told me the story about pitching it to Macy Lipman. Macy Lipman was complaining that Johnny pitched it to Glenn Campbell's producer because he thought it was going to be a hit for Johnny. And Johnny said, what difference does it make?
And he founded the Fifth Dimension, and just an amazing career. And what a solo act Johnny Rivers has been. We'll talk with Johnny Palazzotto more in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A bit more time with music promoter Johnny Palazzotto. You went to California when?
I left in December of 1969.
Right when Johnny Rivers was at Whiskey A Go-Go.
Right.
And you were there into the early 80s, right?
I was there until 1982, yeah.
1982. And during the 60s and 70s, Johnny Rivers was near at the top of the chart consistently. And I got an email right at the end of the show yesterday, and I may have missed a few of his top tens. Poor Side of Town won in 1966, number one. This is Billboard. Memphis, number two in 1964, Secret Agent Man, three in 65, Baby, I Need Your Lovin', number three in 1966, Rockin' Pneumonia and Boogie Woogie Flu, number six in 1972, Mountain of Love, number nine in 1964, and Tracks of My Tears, 10 in 67, and Sway Into the Music, his last top 10 song, number 10 in 1977.
Poor Side of Town was co-written with Lou Adler, the famous producer that you see sitting beside Jack Nicholson at the Lakers games. And Lou and Johnny Rivers were very close in the early days of his career.
You know, I read Adler's book years ago, and he said that back in the, I guess, late 60s, Johnny Rivers had the nicest house in Los Angeles, and he said, you know, I really like this house, Johnny, and he said Johnny just gave him the keys and said, it's yours.
I've been to Johnny's house in Coldwater Canyon.
It's not bad either.
It is spectacular. You have a view of both the valley and the hills.
Well, this, as he noted, is his third appearance at Baton Rouge High.
Right.
Since the renovations began, now they're completed. He'll be there with Zachary Richard, another fine performer, a Saturday night, 7:30, for those who wish to be there.
Tickets are still available at BRMHS at ebrschools.org. Right. That's the Baton Rouge High website, and you can click and print your own tickets. Encourage everybody to do so. It's going to be a great show. Zachary just won his sixth Felix Award in Canada, which is the Grammy parallel in Canada, and Zach's another Louisiana legend. It'll be a great show.
That's BRMHS, Baton Rouge Magnet High School, at
ebrschools.org.
Yes. And it's a beautiful new arena, but the capacity, of course, is limited.
1,300 seats.
It's a good size.
Yeah, it's a classic auditorium. It is probably the best auditorium in this city.
1,300 seats.
Yes.
Wow, that's a few more than I thought. So there is an opportunity for folks who wish to see Johnny Rivers, and at 71, let's face it, he's not going to do this forever. But I saw him a few years ago, and he looked like he was 25.
He's still kicking. He really does put on a good show.
And he wanted to come back to Convention Street last time he was here.
I took him over there and took some pictures of him in front of his duplex house at 4848 Convention Street. Johnny also told some great stories. Elvis Presley played on that same stage back in 1957, I think it was. And Johnny was a student at Baton Rouge High at that time and saw the performance.
He mentioned that. He said he went to see Minnie Pearl, and this young guy comes out, and he thought he was kind of goofy, and then he started playing That's All Right, Mama, and he realized, hey, that's that song we're listening to on the radio.
Yeah.
It's Elvis Presley, the guy he would later cut with with Memphis. Kevin has chosen a selection from Johnny Rivers. I think this is 1971, number 14 it went on charts. Really a fine work from the former John Ramostella. Johnny Rivers, he can play that guitar, too.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir, and he'll be doing it Saturday night. Zachary Richard with him at Baton Rouge Magnet, the new and improved high school auditorium. When Johnny Palazzotto said it's the best auditorium in the city, and we've got some good ones, 1,300 seats. It's BRMHS at ebrschools.org. Wade at Louis says, can Johnny give one good story about his life in California? I bet you're a man of 1,000 stories, at least.
I have the best Janis Joplin story that anybody has ever heard. She was rehearsing, making her comeback with Big Brother and the Holding Company at Studio Instrument Rentals on Santa Monica Boulevard. Being produced by, his name is blanking me, but she came in to make a phone call, person-to-person phone call, collect to her boyfriend in San Francisco, who we later found out was jilting her and was trying to get away from her. She makes a person-to-person call. Obviously, back in those days, you had to go through the operator. Mm-hmm. The operator asks who she is. When the operator finds out it's Janis Joplin, I'm overhearing this conversation in my office. She's using my phone. The operator asked her if she had a tattoo on her breast, which Janis was kind of set back about and explained to the operator, yes, she did, in fact. So when the phone call did not go through, she came up to me and said, I guess you overheard the conversation. Well, you know, I'm 23 years old. I'm kind of like going, I'm blushing a little bit. And Janis says, would you like to see it? And when she said this, the producer walks through the door and says, Janis, we were waiting for you. So I didn't get to see the rose on her breast.
Well, that had to be shortly before she died.
It was about 3 weeks before she died.
Yeah. Tragically. At 27.
At 27.
I read recently that she had an affair with Dick Cavett.
Wouldn't be surprised. Clive Davis was on Letterman show last night and said that she approached him about doing the deal as a confirmation of the deal with CBS.
Wow. Well, Janis was an amazing talent from Port Arthur, Texas.
Great singer, great spirit. She really was.
And has immortalized Baton Rouge in song. Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train. That's one of the most famous openings of any song of all time.
Yes.
And it was, Chris Christopherson?
Chris Christopherson's song.
Chris Christopherson, who wrote it. But Johnny Rivers, who he was talking about how when he opened at the Whiskey A Go-Go, I was looking at some of the people who were there, people like Steve McQueen. He was big stuff. We're talking the mid-60s, and he wasn't that far removed from being with John Fred in Baton Rouge.
It was the beginnings of the heyday of the Sunset Strip, really was.
Well, thank you, Johnny Palazzotto. Good luck Saturday night.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for being here. And we're joined now by Herbie Pilato, who's been with us once before, and he is a man who has kept in touch with one of the late, great stars of the small screen, Elizabeth Montgomery. She was Samantha Stevens on Bewitched, and the latest book from Herbie is The Essential Elizabeth Montgomery, A Guide to Her Magical Performances. Good morning, Herbie.
Well, good morning. Happy Halloween.
Well, I guess that's appropriate. It is an appropriate day to talk to you about a lady who is a witch.
A good witch.
Now, she is remembered most for Bewitched. How long did that series run?
It ran 8 years, and one of the reasons why I wanted to do this book in particular is because she had done so much beyond that show. You know, before Bewitched, she did over 230 guest appearances on shows like The Twilight Zone and The Untouchables, 77 Sunset Strip, Burke's Law, on and on. Anything that was anything on TV in the 50s and early 60s, Elizabeth guested on. And then after Bewitched, she did all those incredible TV movies, like Legend of Lucy Borden, Case of Rape, and on and on.
Well, Elizabeth Montgomery had a career that lasted long after Bewitched, but let's stay with it for just a few moments. There were a couple of Darrens. Paul Lynde was in that series, a really talented cast.
Yes, it was really one of the most diverse casts in TV history. And Paul Lynde, he only did like 8 episodes, but everybody thinks he was like a regular every week, which is really a testament to his talent. But certainly there was Agnes Morad and Morris Evans, who was called Maurice on the show, Samantha's father. Marion Lorne played Bumbling Aunt Clara. Dick York was the original Darren, but he had issues with his back, and he had to leave the series. He was replaced by Dick Sargent in season 6. Alice Ghostly came along and replaced Marion Lawrence's bubbling character of Aunt Clara with a bumbling witch maid known as Esmeralda. I mean, it was just one, you know, incredible regular, semi-regular cast member after the next. And people like Jack Cassidy, Peter Lawford made guest appearances. Just amazing.
Well, the producer was William Asher, correct?
Correct. And he did the Beach Party movies and before then and during the show. And he had married Elizabeth Montgomery. They fell in love on the set of a movie he directed and that she was cast in called Johnny Cool from 1963. That was another thing. She did like three feature films before Bewitched. So they fell in love on that set, and then they decided they wanted to work together, and a series would be the best way to do that, they felt.
Well, and she was Samantha until 1972, and then they divorced shortly thereafter. Her life continued, and her career continued. What were some of the works she did after Bewitched that were prominent that maybe we've forgotten about?
As I mentioned, The Case of Rape was probably the most difficult thing for me to watch. I know I really still have a problem watching Samantha getting raped, you know, or even The Legend of Lizzie Borden. But a Case of Rape was the game changer for her. Her first TV movie that she did after Bewitched was The Victim in 1972 for ABC. And ABC had actually renewed Bewitched for three more years. But Elizabeth did not want to do the show. Everyone felt, well, you know, they canceled the show because of bad ratings. That was not the issue. It was scheduled opposite All in the Family in season 8, its last year. It was holding up just fine. ABC was very happy with the ratings, but Elizabeth did not want to continue. But she still had this contract with them. So instead of doing three more years of Bewitched, she did two movies, The Victim in 1972, and then Mrs. Sundance in 1974. And it's there where she met Robert Foxworth, who she fell in love with, and he was the one who really encouraged her to do more serious-type work, or more dramatic work, which she then did with A Case of Rape, which she was Emmy-nominated for, and then on to Legend of Lizzie Borden with Murder in Mind, and just an incredible amount of... she was the queen of TV movies, mm-hmm. The first queen of TV movies, you know, that was later taken over by Jane Seymour and Valerie Bertinelli. But Elizabeth was queen of the witches on Bewitched, and then she was queen of the TV movies later.
The book is The Essential, Elizabeth Montgomery, A Guide to Her Magical Performances from Herbie Polanto. Now, she was in a TV movie called A Killing Affair in 1977 with O.J. Simpson, a controversial presentation at the time.
Yes, absolutely. That was very interesting. First of all, Bewitched, to her and to many people, is about prejudice. You know, two very different people learning to get along despite their differences. When she did A Killing Affair with O.J. Simpson, you know, obviously because he was African-American and she was Caucasian, it was very controversial because the affair was, or the movie was about two police policemen and a policewoman who fall in love of a different color. Now, apparently and allegedly, I can't confirm this, but apparently and allegedly, O.J. had a thing for Elizabeth off-screen. She was not interested, which, you know, kind of added to the whole controversy surrounding that film. But, of course, that he would later on be involved with allegedly, you know, that horrific murder case that happened later on about a blonde woman, you know, it was being murdered. It was just, you know, just very, very odd and very, very strange.
Well, Elizabeth was barely 62 when she died in 1995. She'd been married to Robert Foxworth for a couple of years. It was a tough departure. It was colon cancer that got her, wasn't it?
Yes, very sad. She tended to fluctuate with her weight, which does not help that kind of situation. And she also had issues, you know, with drinking, which has been discussed in other places. That's not revolutionary by any means. But Bob Foxworth, her loving husband, I believe the two loves of her life were Bob Foxworth and Bill Asher, equal loves of her life. He is the one that, like I said, encouraged her to do the more serious work. But he also said that she never really wanted to get old, you know, and she didn't. She died at 62. So whether that was something she self, you know, or subconsciously created or not, either way, it was very sad that she died way too young, and certainly before the resurgence of Bewitched and the resurgence of classic TV in general.
Well, Herbie Pilanto, thank you for joining us today and sharing your story about Elizabeth Montgomery and its remarkable book, The Essential Elizabeth Montgomery. Appreciate it, Herbie.
Thank you so much.
Happy Halloween, everybody. We'll return tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.